of the lectures given by Dr. Wayne Oates for the Religious Education Workshop at Southeastern Seminary on the 29th of January, 1963.
I must confess that there was one classification of humankind that I did not discuss last night. And that was characters, and I suppose I would be more qualified as one of those than anything else. We've talked, have we not, about spiritual conversation as dialogue and not monologue. And yet there are certain basic conditions for spiritual conversation, and apart from these basic conditions, spiritual conversation can become irresponsible and confused, and the chances of our doing more harm than good are very high. And so I want to talk with you tonight about the subject of developing controlled conditions for working with people. And at the very outset, I would like to say that we cannot work with someone whom we have never met. And therefore, an effective spiritual conversation in the very first place requires what I have chosen to call a meeting. We must meet this person. I am deliberately staying with plain Anglo-Saxon language here. We must meet this person. A mutually meaningful meeting of persons, a reciprocally understood relationship is necessary for a true dialogue concerning one's total way of life. And there are four basic elements that are prerequisite to an effective meeting of minds in a genuinely meaningful and helpful relationship between two people. The first prerequisite is a clear definition of our role or our relationship in this person's life. Now, last night I talked with you about these roles that we fill. You are a music director, or you are a minister of music. You are an educational director, or you are a minister of education, or you are a pastor in a church, or you are a professor in a seminary. This is your formal role. People come to you and to me in these formal roles because of our personages, because of our role. I am not at all deceived. but that many people seek me out because I am connected with a wonderful institution. As a pastor, I could knock on the door of a stranger's home, and I could introduce myself as Wayne Oates, and they would look at me as if to say, "So what?" Because who is Wayne Oates to the stranger? But if I said to that same stranger as I knocked on his door, "I am Wayne Oates. I am the pastor of the Peachtree Baptist Church," then it would not matter so much that I was Wayne Oates, because I had a card of entry. My role was defined. It was clear to them why I was there. There was a relationship of a trusted motive, hopefully, there, or potentially there at least. It was clear to them how I was related to them. Now, I could hope that after I got into the door, and after I had met them, that they would let me come to know them as persons and be known by them as a person without letting the trappings of my card of entry insulate me from them as persons. But as you well know, this is one of the major tasks in visitation, isn't it? Of bursting through the wall of that role that is there in such a way that we encounter each other as persons, as we are, and not just as we appear to be, as we genuinely are, and not as other people have said that we are, or as in the case of a professor, as the student Grapevine has said that we are just as we are and nothing else. But that wall has to be broken through. And as I was thinking about this afternoon, I walked along and saw a very heartbreaking bit of news on the evening paper headline: Robert Frost, 88, is dead. And I was reminded of his poem, "The Mending Wall," in which he says that his neighbor, you know, grows pines and he grows apple trees. And he says that his neighbor's all pine and he's all apple orchard. And my apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. But he only says that good fences make good neighbors. And then Frost says, "But before I build a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in and what I was walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down." I remember reading that poem to our church in Louisville last year about this time, and saying that I wished that Premier Khrushchev could hear that poem. And I did not know that my wish would be granted so soon, because it was this poem that Robert Frost read in Moscow. And someone asked what that meant. He said, "Oh," he said, "I never tell people what my poems mean." And I guess that's the secret of a poet. Because here I can give this poem our own particular meaning here. That is, that the role that we have in a very real sense is a wall. That must be through the process, through the experience of reconciliation, through the settling power of the Holy Spirit, broken down in order that there may be a meeting in which I take up my role and I lay it down. My role becomes a way into this person's life, but at the same time I must learn to exist as a person with that person. For example, I am a father. Many of you are fathers and or mothers. And what a wonderful thing it is when you come to the point that you can exist as one human being to another with your child. And for a moment or two at least, in a beatific revelation, you meet him as a human being and he meets you as a human being. And the business of your identity as a legally responsible parent is somehow or other laid aside. Now, we cannot, though, in our desire to lay aside a role, fail to take it seriously. Because that role represents our responsibility for the person for whom we care. And if we are too careless about laying it aside, then we may be simply fishing out from under our responsibilities. We need to be very careful in doing so that we do not confuse our relationships. I often say that there are three kinds of relationships we have to people. There are formal relationships, in which our role is activated to the full. There are informal relationships in which our role is quiescent and inactive, implicit and not explicit. And then there are confused relationships, in which we try to make one of these do the work of the other. For example, I have many informal relationships with people, just as you do. I am a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, a relative, and these are relatively informal relationships. But if I superimpose the formality of my identity as a professor or as a teacher or as a pastor upon one of these, I get a lot of anxiety back and a lot of confusion of my relationship. I'll give you an example. I had a student once ask me if I experimented as a psychologist with my children. Did I use them as guinea pigs? A And I said, "Do you know what you have just called me?" He said, "I didn't call you anything." I said, "Oh, yes, you did." With a twinkle in whatever there was of my eye that was not glinting. I said, "You just called me a guinea pig. And I resent this." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you asked me if I treated my children as guinea pigs. And I happen to be their father, and if that means that I treat them as guinea pigs, that means that I'm a big guinea pig." He said, "No, I don't treat my children as guinea pigs. I'm their father. That's who I am." They're not counselees. They're not patients. They're not parishioners. They're not members of my choir. They're not members of my class. They are my children. That's how I'm related to them, and I can't confuse my relationship to them. You see the perfect example of it in public speech. Of the pastor or the preacher or the lecturer who, when he's talking to his close friends, never gets out of his identity as a speaker to, say, 200 to 2,000 people. And when he speaks to them, he always speaks this way. "Now, my dear brother," and you look around and... "Well, where are the other two?" As if something has happened. On the other hand, you'll find people who are accustomed to speaking with one-to-one relationships as counselors, who when they're speaking to a crowd of 200 people or 500 people or 1,000 people, who say, "Well, no, it's nice." They never get out of one relationship into another. It's as if they sleep in their armor. Now, occasionally people will come to you and say, "Well, what would you do in such and such an instance? If a person said to you, thus and so, what would you do?" For example, a student sat down with me in the student center one day, and I was passing by a bowl of soup for lunch, and he said, "What would you do with a person who is sick and who won't go to a doctor, and you just think she's sick? She's always complaining, but she's not really sick at all." I said, "Well, it depends on how you are related to this person. Could you tell me how you are related to this person?" He said, "It is my mother." Now, I could very easily have thought that that was a church member of his that he was working with, and that he was related to them as a pastor. What he would do in relation to his own mother would be a very different thing from what he would do in relation to his parishioner. Because she's his mother. And he has kinds of responsibility for her that he does not have for a parishioner, and vice versa. And I said, "Well, how did you decide that she was not sick?" He said, "My father told me so." I said, "Well, how did your father decide this?" "Well, he's always said that." I said, "Well, have you and he thought of getting her to a doctor?" "Well, we tried it, but not recently." I said, "Well, if it was my mother and she was sick, I would get her to a doctor before I decided she wasn't sick." "She may well be sick." And we went ahead and talked about his mother as his mother. Now, he had confused his identity as a pastor here with his identity as a son to his mother. And this is what you call a confused relationship. Now, you could turn it around the other way and likely get confusion back, in which you treat a church member of yours as if she were your mother. As if she were a member of your family. And I have seen students who became so deeply related to their church members as well nigh members of their family that they could not perform the more formal responsibilities of caring for the family as a pastor, for example, when a death came in the family. They would simply go the way all of the children went and lose their sense of identity as a person who was supposed to be a part of the solution and not a part of the problem. Now, I think this is basic in developing a controlled relationship of communication with people, and that is that we clarify what our relationship is with these people. Now, in the second place, in developing a controlled relationship to people, we must pay attention to the place in which we try to be of assistance to them. For example, you are a choir master, let us say. And one of your choir members tarries a little while after choir practice. Now, it could well be that you have just been through three choir practices that day with the graded choirs we have today. But this person has a burden on their heart, and they want to talk with you about it. And yet you are fatigued, and yet you are in a situation where they cannot talk with you privately. And instead of discussing the matter with them there, you move to a more controlled situation, say in an office, or to a place of discreet privacy, anywhere you can find it. I have, as a rural pastor, found discreet privacy with a person I wanted to work with, sitting on a woodpile. I'm not talking about the status symbols of sitting behind somebody's desk, you see. I'm talking about creating enough psychic space around you that you can be private with this person. It may be no more than the privacy that your back gives you in a ward where there are 40 people. And you can create a little privacy with your back by turning a certain way with the rest of the crowd. But preferably, you would have a room that was discreetly located where there are other responsible people in the building with you, where you would give them privacy. It is better to do this. If you're going to use your own home, use a home, it's better to have the person in your home than it is to visit in theirs, for the simple reason you can control who comes in and who goes out in a way that you can't if you're in their house. And you have a place of discreet privacy. Now, I think you can symbolize the formality or informality of your relationship to people by the place at which you meet them. If I want to be very informal with a person, I'll say, well, let's drink a cup of coffee together in the student center. If I want to be a little, have more privacy than that will afford, I may say, well, could you come by the house this evening and sit down with me? And if I want a great deal of formality and control, I will meet them in my office. And there are certain situations I wouldn't attempt to deal with anywhere else but in my office. Because I want the controls that that gives me as to place and the privacy that it gives me. And I do not meet people in that office when there's no one else in that building. For the simple reason that they will misinterpret the meaning of this extremely private meeting. Or some accident or peradventure of the situation may arise in which you will need the assistance of other people. I shall never forget learning this the hard way when a person that I met, a man, I met him before classes, before an 8 o'clock class. I met him at 7:15 in my office one morning. And in my office there, he had an epileptic fit. I thought he was having a heart attack, and I grabbed for the phone, and the switchboard wasn't open. I looked in the hall, there was no one there, and there I was with this man, you see, scared to death. And I said, I think I'll put that in my outline the next time I lecture on a controlled relationship. See, this is the control of a discrete place where you have facility at hand to meet the person's need. I have seen quite often relationships also get completely confused by the simple fact that the pastor, the music director, the religious education director insisted on doing all of his work with people on a very, very informal basis. And in the home or on trips and the like. And this is where the relationship gets confused and a lot of damage is done to people. You would do better quite often not to be trying to work with the person than to do that. Now then, the third factor or condition in a controlled relationship is what I call initiative. Initiative. We do not have money to give in great quantities to causes, but we do have initiative that can be taken. And the amount of initiative that is taken in a given relationship should be determined on the basis of a conscious decision. Because in a large measure it determines how much help we can genuinely bring other people. One of the things that impresses me profoundly about our Lord and Savior's ministry was the way in which he stimulated, exerted acts of faith in the lives of people whom he helped. He was talking with a woman at the well in a very informal setting at a well, asking for a drink of water. And he asked her to do something for him. Woman, go get thy husband and bring him here. And this focused the core of her anxiety. With lepers, stretch forth thy hand. With lame people, take up thy bed. Simple acts of exerted faith. Go show thyself to the priest. Now, I have a feeling that when we take people's initiative away from them, when we don't fan the little flame of it to an increasing fire, we are likely to do them more damage than we are good. For example, there are different grades of initiative that I want you to be sensitive to. I would like for you to develop what the Germans call Fingerspitzengefühl, or it's the sensitivity of a wet finger in the wind. To the amount of initiative in a given relationship. And there are different gradations of that. I suppose that the lowest degree of initiative is when you shake hands with somebody after a service or after a choir practice or after an officers and teachers meeting, there is a certain communication in the hand that says, I would like to talk with you, or something's bothering me. Another way, degree of initiative, it's what I call underlining words. Well, where is Jack tonight? Well, he said he couldn't come. You see, she underlined said. He said he couldn't come. It's almost a semaphore that I'm in trouble, this underlining of words. And anxiety always works with a red pencil underlining. See? Now, the next degree of initiative is to write you a note. The person writes you and says, there's something bothering me and I want you to pray for me. I can't tell you what it is now, but I want you to pray for me. And you write, get a note from the person. The next degree of it is a telephone call. Now, a telephone call gives the person a voice, but saves their face. And they may call you and want to talk with you by telephone. The next degree of initiative is a request that you come to see them. A request that you come to see them, that you visit them in their home. I suppose the strongest degree of initiative is that they come to see you. or they call you and ask you for an appointment. Now that is the strongest degree of initiative. When they call you and say, I want to see you, when could I see you? They have put the full thrust of initiative in coming toward you. Now, in the same way, the amount of initiative you take can be graded. There are many ways of breaking through into people's, through the wall of people's resistance to help by degrees of initiative. You can shake hands in a certain way. You can underline your speech. How are things with you today? Are things better now? You can underline. And you can write a note and say, I had the feeling in officers and teachers meeting the other night that you might have been carrying a burden, and I wanted to write you this little note this morning and to tell you that in the quietness of my private personal prayers I have named you in my prayers, praying that God will give you strength. Or it may well be that you know from having talked with the other partner of a marriage that this person is having marriage troubles. And it may be that you won't want to go to see this person, but that you would want to write them a note. Or you may want to take a little more initiative and pick up your phone and say, John, I talked with Mary at her request, and she's given me her permission to call you. And I wanted you to know that I am your friend and that I would like to see you, but I don't want to foist my friendship upon you. And after we finished our conversation here, you can just hang up and forget about it if you would like. But I didn't want you to think that I didn't care and that I would not come to see you or make it possible for you to come to see me. You can take that much initiative. You say, well, that's not in Dr. Rogers' book on counseling and psychotherapy. Well, it may not be in his book, but he's not a pastor either. And he's not a church music director. And he's not a religious education director. Let's let him be his personage and let's us be our personages and know who we are and rejoice in it. In other words, we don't have to be dominated by psychotherapeutic concepts at this point. A pastor, a religious worker, is expected to take initiative. And if there is any one thing missing, it's what I call pastoral passivity, which shades over into pastoral neglect and deepens into the dark purple hues of pastoral carelessness. Now, you can write a letter, you can make a telephone call, you can make a visit. And when you do visit, you have put on the whole armor of your identity, whatever it is, and you have moved in with force. to deal with a situation. Now, the objective of a visit would be to stimulate initiative, to encourage this person now to come to you. And pastoral visitation, Sunday school teacher visitation, choir leader visitation, religious education workers visitation is a part of our work with people. One of the most effective things that I have seen done in our family as a family with my wife and our two sons by our church was when a church music director took enough initiative to write our 9-year-old son a letter in his own hand. And then a little more initiative and came to see him. And when he, on the third attempt, got him into the choir, the little boy came back and said, "That man, John Sims, is a real man." He said. That was his evaluation of the situation. And he's right, too. Now, I think this applies in all of our ministries, not just pastors. Finally, there is another factor of control in relationship, and that is in time, in the use of time. And I saved it till last to remind you that I'm under that discipline now, you see. What we do with people is shaped by our own finitude. We have only one thing to give away, really, in addition to initiative, and that is time. And we should be disciplined experts in the use of time. It's all we have to give away. It is the principle of the cross in working with people. When I give you time, when you give me time, you have given me 50 minutes of your time. You have crucified unto whatever good purpose we could bring forth together here that much of your life. This is the principle of the cross in the giving of life, is in the giving of time. Now, in working with people, sensitivity to time and the control of time is necessary. There are some concerns of people that cannot be dealt with on a touch-and-go basis because they involve major decisions in that person's life. And this is the kind of problem you sit down with. There are other problems that you walk along with. As you're in the way with the person, you simply keep walking with the person. There are other problems that you simply touch and let go. But there are other problems which you don't just sit down once with, but you develop a continuity of conversations with the person concerning them. And making those distinctions is a large part of the business of caring for people. If it's your children, if it's your wife, if it's your husband, if it's your neighbor, if it's one of your colleagues, if it's one of your church members, apportioning the time to fit the need is a part of the art and the science of working with people. Now, in my own ministry, I like to see a person about a serious concern of his at least once in private when we can sit down, idle our engine, maybe even turn the switch off, and simply think out loud with each other. In the process of this, I like to let that person know what kind of time limits I'm under. If I have a class at 12 o'clock and this is at 11:35, I will be frank with him if I don't have the time at that point and say, "I'm crowded. I couldn't listen to you with my whole mind because I got this class coming on, but as soon as I come off that class, I'll have a free mind, and then I can give all of it to you for an hour. Could you come back at 1 o'clock? And then I can give him an hour. Now, if he comes a long distance, and I won't get to see him again, well, I may work beyond an hour. But ordinarily, I work in less than an hour with people. If you know the person real, real well, you can come down to 45 minutes or 30 minutes. But you know the secret in the use of time is to give people your full attention when you are dealing with them. I would rather for a person to give me 10 minutes of undivided attention than an hour of split attention. And this is the only reason for rescheduling times with people, is so you can give them your full attention. And if you do that and nothing else, if you give them your full attention, to the exclusion of everyone else, you've helped them. You've told them you cared. Now, these are the four factors, and we're working sort of workshop fashion here. A clearly defined role, a discreet and secure play, a carefully understood and developed initiative, and a good stewardship of time. If I have those four factors under control, then I have a relatively anxiety-free relationship. And the person can see things more steadily and see them whole, and so can I. And I can give him my whole being, and conversation takes place. Now we have one more discussion tomorrow, and that is on the Holy Spirit and the helping relationship. I'm going to be extremely brash and take a great deal of initiative here tonight, because I saw my wife come in, and I want you to know her. She's right back there somewhere, and I want to ask her if she'll stand. She'll probably knock me down for this point.